Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the KE Report Weekend Show. Corey and Chad here, your hosts for this weekend's edition. We're going to be talking in the first half of the show, energy, natural gas, oil, trying to make sense of not necessarily the situation in Iran, but more what prices are doing, how companies are faring, and even a bit of an earnings recap. Back half of the show, we're going technical for everybody, and because I think in these type of markets where everyone's trying to attribute a story to why markets are moving the way they are, we really do need to be following technicals and trends, because boy, oh boy, that's been working if you've been in certain sectors, and more importantly, avoiding other sectors. If you want to listen to all our daily editorials and company updates from throughout the week, visit our website, kereport.com. And in your podcast player or on YouTube, search the KE Report. Let's get into this weekend's show. We're chatting with Joseph Schachter. Joseph is the founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report. Also writes the Eye on Energy Report. That is on Substack. If you sign up for the Schachter Energy Report, you get to join Joseph on quarterly webinars where Joseph dives into specific company reports and answers all of your questions. Joseph, let's start off with what's going on in the oil price. We are recording this about halfway through the day on Tuesday, so who knows what's going to happen the rest of this week, but oil has been volatile, experienced a little bit of a pullback, but as we're recording this, right around that $101 a barrel level. Look, this is still being driven a whole lot by he said, she said type of things for the Iran war. That war still seems like it's going on, at least as we're recording this, just in a maybe slightly less fashion. Joseph, talk to us about the oil price, where you see it going, and really what's going to drive this longer term.
Well, the key thing for oil is the longer it lasts, the more difficult the storage situation becomes in Europe and Asia, particularly in Asia, where as the inventories run down, then they can't make as much jet fuel, diesel fuel. And so, you know, while we're talking, you know, Brent is 107.32, up 3.11 today, and WTI 101.54, up 3.47. So you got about a $6 spread there between the two. Brent products are trading over $200 a barrel in Asia. So that's the big problem is the product. And if they run out of product, then allocations come in, and then some industries have to shut. We've already seen Reliance in India saying they're not going to make as much jet fuel and diesel fuel because they need fuel for you know, for cooking in the continent there, and so they're already beginning to be the signs. And you know, in Europe, Sweden and a few others are doing it in Northern Europe, where they're beginning to allocate product to where it's needed, and those who are lower on the priority scale are not getting access to product, and means factories are closing. So the longer this lasts, the higher the price goes. I think, you know, you could add $3-4 US per week as you get into the end of May. I think if this thing is still going on and the fighting is going on, or there's no resolution, in other words, the Americans go back to a war footing next week, and you know, the supposed love taps are over and we go to a fighting stance again with Israel, you know, joining the United States in major attacks on, you know, Karg Island and on infrastructure of, you know, military assets of the IRGC, then I think, you know, you're looking at higher and higher prices. The 120 or just sub 120 that we saw at the beginning of the war, I think that could get exceeded in June if this thing drags out. And as you're seeing from major U.S. brokerage firms, more and more people are coming out with that if this lasts into June, then if there's not enough demand destruction, then we are going to see a severe recession, not a recession, but a severe recession. And that's probably the most worrisome thing, is if the economies go off the cliff, because energy is such a big input. We saw today the, you know, the inflation data, which was, you know, worse than was expected. And inflation from energy is a big component of it. But there's other components that are also, you know, pushing inflation up. So are we back into kind of 1970s inflation, where it's not just one commodity, but it's food, insurance, housing costs, you just add it and it spreads throughout an economy. That's the worst case for the central banks.
Well, Joseph, as you outlined, the longer this goes on, the more ramifications there's going to be. Now on Wall Street, there's the nacho trade. I don't know if you guys have heard of this, but we've talked about the taco trade before, but now the nacho trade. So sticking with that theme, they're saying that means not a chance Hormuz opens. So there's some people that have now resigned to the fact that it's probably not going to open because a lot of countries are going to be too nervous to even try to navigate the strait. Let's just go through the hypothetical. If in a situation where the Strait of Hormuz is closed down, not just for a couple more weeks or a month, but let's just say the rest of this year. What would that mean for oil prices? Because the nacho trade is live and in effect.
Yeah, so there's the issue of 20 million, which is the gross amount of product and also, crude that comes out of the Persian Gulf. But there's also, of course, helium. There's also, of course, the fertilizer issue. So there's a lot of components to the effects of economies and the price of, sulfur on the FOB Vancouver right now is $1,000 a ton. That was under 200 going back a year ago. And so I think we're looking at some very, very expense for farmers going forward. Bottom line is, from my point of view, is the closure means that, first thing, Saudi Arabia has a pipeline that goes from the Persian Gulf to the west. And if the Houthis do not get told by Iran to attack the shipping, then that can, take 6 million barrels to 7 million barrels. So 20 minus, let's say, 6 gives you that, right away there's only 14. Iraq is also building a pipeline that goes to Turkey that could take 1.5 million to it. It's an old pipeline. They're going to add more capacity, more pumping. So that could take 2 million. So then that number could end up being like 12 million barrels, but 12 million barrels on 106 is still a big number. And so once inventories get taken down, I'll throw some numbers at you. The last EIA report that included 2025 data pre-war, we had like 90 days of global inventories onshore and offshore. And the range normally is between 88 and 92. So it was right in the middle. We know that's come down because of the war. The highest number we ever had was, 120 days during COVID. The lowest number we ever had was in mid-2008 when we had that run up to 100, nominally $147 a barrel, and we went down to 79 days. There's a lot of talk that the data that's coming out this Wednesday from OPEC could show that we've gone from 90 days to maybe 84 or 85 days. So we're pushing the down a lot. So every month that it continues to have the war, then that's going to be driving that number to the 79. And if we get below 79, I think then you're looking at spiky kind of parabolic price potential on the upside until demand destruction balances out. So, when you hear some people alarmists saying $200 a barrel, it's not a 1% probability anymore. The probability potentially is higher the longer the war lasts. And the Iranian leadership, the hawks, the IRGC hawks, seem to think that the longer they stay in power, and the more the war becomes unpopular in the United States, like Vietnam was, then you may see the American public will push the government to take a lousy deal, and Iran wins. You've seen Iran's request that they get compensation, that they get all of their assets that were frozen released. There's no comments about anything related to their nuclear program, no comments about them supporting terrorism. So they get a lot of what they want, and the Americans just get the Straits of Hormuz open with tariffs going to Iran. That's a lose-lose situation for Trump, and I don't put the probability at all, low probability that he accepts a deal like that. But those are the two, extremes where the, it doesn't open up at all. Which is a the spiky price, parabolic price, or he accepts a deal and it opens up and Iran wins big time and Trump loses big time.
Okay, Joseph, I have two more questions on the oil market. One, on the supply side, I've read some stories that potentially the U.S. has been releasing oil from the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Is that the case? Have you seen that? And then on the demand side, when are we going to start to see demand destruction? Because look, gas prices in Vancouver, they're fluctuating, but they've been up to 220 a liter. And on the airline front, all I'm reading about week after week is airlines canceling flights. So again, demand side, SPR, is it true the US is releasing some oil? Demand side, aren't we going to see some serious demand destruction here?
Well, let's start with the SPR. I have the EIA data in front of me that I just pulled out while you're asking the question. And the SPR last week released 5.2 million barrels. It's now 392.7, and it's down 6.4 million barrels from 399 a year ago. So the SPR is being drawn down. And a lot of that is because of the export situation. The U.S. is exporting 4.75 million barrels last week. The high was 6.4 a few weeks ago. Again, that can move between shipping. There's a lot of ships heading to the U.S. Gulf Coast, and that number could probably go to an all-time high. If you look at the four-week average, the four-week average is 5.6 million barrels a day of exports, net exports. 5.3 million of net exports, and that's up 26% from 4.2 a year ago. So the American exports are really big. The big question is the demand side, as you mentioned, and the U.S. demand is not slowing down. Again, this is EIA data from last week. We'll get new data Wednesday, but the U.S. consumption year to date is 20.7 million. That's up 3.1% from 20.1. So the U.S. demand is up. If you go to the subcomponents, gasoline, it's up 0.6 to 8.7 million from 8.6 million. The one that's down is jet fuel, which is down 0.7%. But when you go into things like distillate, it's up 1.7. And then other oils, which makes the plastics and all the things that we consume, that's up 12.7 to 4.9 million from 4.3. So remember, we use a lot in transportation, but we're using more and more to create the products that we use every day, which have plastics in them, and heavy duty plastics, your computer, a background, your glasses, things we use all the time. And so that's really the key, is the other oils component.
Well, just sticking with the demand theme, Joseph, there's been a lot of messaging from the energy market in a broad sense that people are looking at other things outside of oil. So for example, because Europe has been so dependent on Russian natural gas and the oil from the Strait of Hormuz, they're now looking at coal again, or they're trying to revive certain renewable projects. You have Japan coming out and saying maybe it's time to push forward a little heavier with nuclear. A lot of other countries echoing that sentiment and pushing the nuclear side of things because they're seeing that they don't want to be too dependent on any one energy input. Could there be larger knock-on effects of this for the oil industry as people look to generate power in different ways?
Well, the question is, how long does it take to bring on? Nuclear is a long lead time item, so it could be 5 to 10 years, maybe longer. Coal probably can be quicker because you have coal mines in Poland and Germany that they were closed down because of the environmentalists. They could reverse that and bring that on and reopen those coal-fired facilities so that they can get the power they need when it comes to winter 26-27. Lead time on solar, lead time on wind is pretty long. So again, it's not going to be an immediate solution. The only commodities that really can solve the problem in 2026 are going to be coal and natural gas. And of course, of the two, natural gas is cleaner. And the U.S. is now shipping 18 to 19 BCF a day. We in Canada are shipping 2 BCF, which is L&D Canada running at full capacity. And of course, we're waiting to see the FID on LNG Canada too. We saw Shell buy ARC, so they got more reserves to backstop them. So we'll have to wait and see, if they're going to announce the coastal expansion, and those are going to be positives for the industry. And I think, coal is something that we won't do in Canada, but you'll probably see, Europe and Asia, of course, they're still, India and China are still building massive amounts of coal-fired power plants to meet the needs that they have domestically. Europe would probably just use what they have. They probably won't build more power plants because, the lead time on that is long, and they'll probably be focused on renewables. And of course, as you mentioned, they would be focusing on nuclear.
What about nat gas? Why is nat gas so boring right now? It hasn't done anything but really move down and consolidate at a lower level for the last month. Yes, it's bounced a little bit from the lows in April of about 250, but nat gas is cheaper than it pretty much was all last year, and it's boring. Nat gas is usually not a boring market. Why isn't there more interest in nat gas? Why isn't this war affecting nat gas more? What's going on, Joseph?
Well, NYMEX today is 282. It's down 9 cents on the day. The big problem is the Permian. The Permian is producing record amounts of oil. As it moves more and more into New Mexico, the opportunity for, because the government's opening up land there, there's going to be more and more production. I don't know if the number is 6 million barrels a day is coming from the Permian shales right now. So that is a big number. And as a byproduct, you have natural gas. And so, if there's no pipelines to take the natural gas, then you've got to get a flare permit. If you can't get a flare permit, then you're almost saying to somebody, "Hey, come and grab this gas, liquefied petroleum, or put in a pipeline, and we'll pay you to take the gas." So there's negative pricing in some basins of the Permian because there's no takeaway capacity and you don't have flare permits. So it's the drag from the Permian that I think is keeping U.S. prices depressed. And then, of course, how does that change? Weather. So if we get into a high temperature summer, which is not that far away, and we have extremely hot temperatures, then air conditioning demand will be high. Again, as more and more data centers get built, so that's going to increase demand. So between weather and data centers, that's going to be the one that changes the situation. And, a lot of us are hoping that'll happen during the second half of 2026.
Well, Joseph, let's maybe pivot over to some of the energy companies. A lot of people listening probably investing in the energy stocks, oil and gas stocks, or oil services. Maybe we'll kick it off with oil services because we were talking off mic about the need for more pipeline, the need for more infrastructure. I think this is causing people to go back to the map and look at how they move liquids and gases around. Anything in the oil services sector you want to highlight?
Well, I was just on the Trican call, which reported their results yesterday, and they do a conference call over the quarter, and it was a very upbeat comment. There's not a lot of new capacity that can come on. As demand picks up, the utilization rate goes up. They get paid by the hour, so that helps out. There's now a talk about wet sand, which means the loads are heavier, so you can't put as much sand in each load to deliver it to the site, which means they'll be needing more trucks. And also the trucks are now going to be natural gas, fired versus diesel. And again, the cost, I think the comment was that at the site, the use of diesel can be $150,000 a day more than if you use natural gas. So that, of course, for an operator, a driller, an E&P company, that's a big number. So I think that, we're going to see the service sector portion. First thing, it'll be the people in the compression business will do really well because they're going to need more compression out there, and pricing there will go up. We've seen GE Vernova and some of the big, direct names in that area, have Caterpillar moving to all-time highs. So the compression game is going to be a positive one. Then I think it's the frackers, and that's where, Trican comes in, and Calfrac, and others in that area. Liberty in the United States would be one there. And then you go into the drillers, and I think a lot of companies are now using the word growth, which means more drilling activity. And if that happens in, Q3, during the summer, the board say yes, and then they get active late in Q3, September, and then they're very active during winter, to Q4 and winter 26, 27, then day rates will go up for the drillers. Some of the ones that we really like, we're big fans of Ensign in total. Ensign today is up 4.9%, 20 cents to 431. That's a new 52-week high. And then you go to Total Energy, it's trading today at up, at 23.33, up 0.8%, but it's within a buck and a quarter of its all-time, or of its all-time high. So I think that these stocks still have a long way to go. As they get higher utilization, that helps. And then as they get pricing power, that helps. And they still have a large increase in pricing before you can justify new builds. So I think we're, let's say, early in the innings for the service sector. And I recommend people to have an exposure to natural gas, which is the Montney Duvernay exposure to the oily side. So you look at names like, Surge and, other names like that that give you the oil exposure, Bonterra, and then the big names like, Whitecap and others that can fit the bill there. And then on the oil, natural gas side, of course, Tourmaline, Birchcliff, Pinecliff, names that you guys know are places to go for that. And then I think, you look at the service sector and, in my case, we personally own Trican. And so it's more than doubled since we purchased it, a few years ago. Plus you're getting a very nice dividend. So they've bought back half the stock and since they announced the beginning of their NCIB around COVID time. So, if they keep on doing an active NCIB, that just adds, it's almost like an M&A where they're buying their own company. And they're saying they know the company, they know the value, they know the upside, and they know the replacement costs of putting on the next frac fleet.
Yeah, I'm glad we started with the oil services because to me, that's been the outperformer in the energy sector. Look at OIH. It has pretty much doubled in the last year. And that's all in the face of rig counts not moving. Baffles me that rig counts haven't even started to tick up, really. So maybe that's still the growth avenue. But let's also talk about the balance between the actual oil producers. Large versus small, in a broad sense, where are you seeing the most strength? Where are you seeing the most opportunity? Is it in the big names or the smaller names?
Well, let's go back to your comment about the rig count is not growing. You have to take into account meterage. Technology today is allowing them to do, in the old days we talked about 1 mile wells. Now we're talking 2, 3, 4, 5 mile a day, the horizontal sections. So the ability with the technology, improved drill bits, improved steel, all of that, open hole, multi-leg, all the things that we're seeing. The amount of meterage has gone up significantly, even though the rig count hasn't gone up. And so maybe we don't need as many rigs, assuming we get, meterage continue to grow. And with the US government opening up more and more land, I think you'll see meterage go up there. And we're seeing the companies in Canada talking about drilling longer reach wells, multi-leg wells. So the meterage is going up in Canada. And interesting, last week we did see the rig count go up in Canada, even though, remember, spring breakup is still on in some places, but a lot of places, spring breakup is over. Going to the valuations between big and small, the multiples in Canada are cheaper than the US, so that's the first thing. And our basins are now getting attracted. We saw Shell come in to buy ARC. I think we're going to see a lot more big boys from around the world knocking on the door. We keep on hearing in Calgary about ConocoPhillips knocking on doors looking for deals. Private equity's up here like crazy. We hear that from a large number of companies that are having conversations with private equity. And also European companies are beginning to look in here. We already have the Chinese companies in Canada that could make other deals, if they wanted to. So, if Canada and China do a, kind of a peace deal on trade, maybe the Canadian government will say, okay, you're allowed to come in here and buy some of the assets that are available. So I think that concentration of the Montney play, Duvernay, Clearwater, oil sands, is all part of it. And, so if you look at the big boys, that's where the foreigners come in, and that's where the big institutions come in. Buying Suncor, CNQ, Cenovus is probably the first stab, but we're beginning to see more and more where people going to medium-sized companies because they see the opportunity. We've seen, Inplay do very well, Obsidian do very well. You're seeing, Surge going to new highs. The 1017 was the 52-week high. It's 989 today. So there's lots of opportunity here, to see much higher prices, going out into the outlier years. So I would look at exposure. I think the value, like companies, there's three numbers to keep in mind: PDP, which is proved developed producing, which is what the banks lend against. There's proven, which is proved and proved producing and proved non-producing. And then you have proved plus problem, which is 2P. Companies used to trade at the going back in April of last year when we had the low, we sent out that action alert buy signal. They were trading below PDP. Most of them now are trading around 1P. So the goal is to get to 2P, and 2P could be a double or a triple from where we are today. So that's really the upside from here. And remember, those numbers are for NEV are based on a 2025 December 31st commodity price decks. And of course, if the price of oil is much higher, which we know it is, and if the price of natural gas is higher on December 31, 26 than it was on December 31, 25, then I think we're going to see much higher NAVs. So if we go from 1P of a higher number to 2P, that could be a three or four bagger. So I think there's so much opportunity in the sector. We're writing up now the Q1 reports of companies, those that are, you know, that are had a good quarter, low, you know, continue to lower their op costs, you know, paying down debt. But we also are looking, and the ones that are our preference are ones that are showing that they have a growth wedge in their business. And those that do have the growth wedge for the second half of 26, those are the ones we're saying people should go after, because those are the ones that, you know, if you have higher growth, high commodity prices, more and more cash flow. And with that cash flow, you can put it back in the ground or you can do shareholder returns. So I think there's a win-win coming both from a growth side and also shareholder return side for the companies with a growth wedge. And you know, we can talk about, you know, names. If we start with conservative, the larger names, you know, Birchcliff's going to go from 83,000 to 87,500. They're going to report results on Wednesday. You go to, you know, Paramount Resources, they just upped their numbers and the results that came out overnight. Strathcona's got built-in oil sands growth. Tourmaline Oil's got built-in growth. And, you know, then Vermilion, because of what they're doing in Germany, Whitecap with, you know, all the stuff they've done with the Veren acquisition. So that's the growth conservative side. You go to the growth side, you know, you've got Bonterra Energy, which is one of our favorites. We've talked before. You know, if you're looking at, you know, the sulfur and all the wind there, Cavvy Energy is a great name to own. Gran Tierra's oily in Colombia, doing very well in Ecuador. In play, of course, the Cardium acquisition they did from Obsidian is doing okay, is doing well. You know, Logan is another name, you know, which is involved in the Montney Duvernay, growing fast. Obsidian, of course, we've talked about, they're active and very active now. Pinecliff is, you know, is doing now. Glockwells, and those are, you know, they've done their first one that's going to come on. Surge is doing very well on their Sparky play, and that's a big upside. And then Valeura, which is the offshore Thailand, has got built-in growth. So there's so many names, and we still have the entrepreneurial li list, which we're not, well, I haven't talked about, but those companies have growth too. So as we write up the quarterly reports, people can just go to, you know, our website, to, you know, www.schachterenergyreport.ca. They can see old copies of our research, and then they can decide if they want to, you know, have us update them, because ours is independent. It's not impacted by corporate finance that it is at the bank-owned firms. So I think we provide a great product. And, you know, our subscriber count has gone up 60% over the last 9 months. And a lot of it is from international. We were originally a product of Western Canada, you know, with Money Talks, Michael Campbell helping us launch this in 2017. And I would say half of our subscribers now are international. They want to invest in Canada. So we've got European, we've got Asian, we've got Australian, we've got, you know, large American following now. And it's all because, you know, our basin is more attractive, less drilled up, longer reserve life indices, and the cost of the companies is cheaper than equivalent American ones.
Well, Joseph, just sewing some of the comments together that you just made, as far as the growth wedge from companies, as far as companies paying down their debt, as far as companies investing in the future. I mean, we just have had some of the Q1 numbers come in, and I think a lot of people forget that the higher prices kind of only came at the tail end of Q1. So it's really going to be Q2 and moving forward that we see maybe higher sustained prices. Do you think that causes companies to dial back the return to shareholder part, the dividends and the share buybacks and the paying down of debt, to focus more on the growth wedge? I mean, could it be that when we get Q2 numbers, some companies that have been doing only the return to shareholder part say, "Eh, maybe we should hit the growth button." Do you think that comes in Q2?
I think the pressure, the peer pressure, is going to focus companies that have not said anything about growth to start adding growth. But when you talk about at the NCIB, if you know the assets and you're looking at M&A, do you go and buy somebody else's assets, or do you buy your own through buying your shares? Because let's say if, you know, if your stock's trading at 15, you think your company's worth 25, and if you have to go out there and pay 25 for somebody else's assets, doesn't it make sense to continue the NCIB? But also peer pressure and the fact that companies, you know, like any organization, it wants to grow. It doesn't want to stagnate. So the pressure is going to be on to grow because you've got a G&G team, geology, geophysics team, exploration teams that can say, hey, we've got these great plays. We want to drill them up. You know, if we have a success on the exploration, it gives us 20 development locations and the rate of return is under a 1 year payback. Well, that boards are going to have to sit there and say, you know, do we want to just stagnate and buy back our shares and just increase the value for the remaining shareholders, or do we want to grow and then also have that as part of our value creation? And if you're looking for an exit strategy of saying, look, we want to grow and have a, you know, very attractive portfolio for somebody to come knock it on the door to buy us out, you know, if the management doesn't feel that they want to be entrenched, they're going to do what's best for the shareholders. So a growth wedge is important. If you're looking to say, okay, X down the road, we want to make this big enough that somebody comes knocking on the door, that means you got to have a growth wedge.
All right, Joseph, thank you for all these insights. Boy, oh boy, the energy sector has definitely been the most interesting this year. Most recently, too, there's a little bit of moves in the hardware and infrastructure build out for AI data centers. But holy, the oil market, it's all you can read about on really headlines all over the world right now. So these stocks are doing well. It's surprising that they're not just continuing to scream to all-time highs as they are making money, but there is that indecision in this market. But you've given us a lot to consider here. So we'll wrap it up here. Again, Joseph Schachter, founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report, also the editor of the Eye on Energy Report on Substack. I will post links to both of those reports in the show notes on our weekend show. Joseph, thanks for your time this weekend, everyone. Stick around. We're going to be right back, switching our focus a little bit more simply to the charts.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.